This is an interview with Carol Summerhouse. Carol will be speaking with me, Edward Helgeby, for the oral history program conducted by Old Parliament House. On behalf of the Chief Executive Officer of Old Parliament House, I would like to thank you for agreeing to participate in this program. Do you understand that the Commonwealth owns copyright in the interview material, but disclosure will be subject to any disclosure restrictions you impose in completing the formal consent?
I understand, yes. Agreed.
This being so, may we have your permission to make a transcript of this recording should Old Parliament House decide to make one?
Certainly.
We hope you will speak as frankly as possible, knowing that neither the tapes nor any transcript produced from them will be released without your authority. This interview is taking place today on 20 January 2009 at Old Parliament House. Can we begin with a little bit of background on your parents and when and where were you born?
Okay, I was born in April 1942 in a suburb called Turramurra in Sydney. My parents were Juanita, my mother, who was born at Bellingen and died 2 years or so ago. My father was George Summerhayes, who was born in Sydney in 1908 and died about 1976. My father had been in the Air Force through the Second World War when we lived in Sydney. He worked for his father when he came back from the war at the Metropolitan Business College in Sydney, which my grandfather, his father, had founded. But they had a falling out at some stage, and my father then joined the Commonwealth Public Service in Canberra. And we came to Canberra in 1957.
So where were you actually? Where were you actually born?
I was born in Sydney, in Turramurra, and my siblings were all born there. We came to Canberra, as I say, in 57. I finished off school here. I did my first 3 years of high school in Sydney and my last 2 years of high school here in Canberra.
At which school?
Canberra High School.
So when you came to Canberra, where did you live?
We moved into a house which had been allocated eventually to my family in Yarralumla, which was on the edge of town. It was an outer suburb in those days. We had sort of dirt roads up from where we lived to the American Embassy and lots of dust, no trees much. It was a pretty bare landscape. No lake. We used to have to ride across the Lucerne Flats to school. Not that I rode to school every day, but for sport on a Saturday, I rode my bike over. So, very different from how it looks now.
And this was when Canberra High School was at what's now the ANU campus.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. What was it like to living in Canberra at that time?
Well, as I say, I had only 2 years of high school here. It was very different from... we'd been living in an outer suburb of Sydney called St Ives, which was pretty much a sort of market garden, sort of newly developing suburb, pretty... countryfied, you know, lots of trees, kids with horses, not that we had them, and freedom. Canberra was pretty much the same, so I didn't really come from an inner city environment to a country environment, but the suburban environment of St Ives was not very different from the sort of country environment of Canberra. I remember particularly we came down here to have a look at the house that had been allocated to my parents, and my father was a bit of a car buff. We had a Javelin. We set off from Sydney at Sparrows one morning to come to Canberra and have a look at this house, and we only got as far as the Razorback and the car conked out, so we had to go back to Sydney, where my father spent all the rest of that day with the bonnet of the car up, hissing and spitting and cursing at this car. And so the next morning we got up again, did the same trip, managed to get over the top of the Razorback, got to Canberra, and I remember we stopped at one of those old wooden bus sheds out on the Cotter Road for a picnic lunch, and we could hardly eat it for the flies. There just were all these terrible little sheep flies. That's probably my strongest memory of that first vision of Canberra. I hadn't been here before.
Mm. So did you find it difficult to adjust to life here?
Not at all. No. I mean, you had to make new friends, but I mean, every time you change schools, you have to do that. And school here was, for me, a bit different in that it was co-educational, and the school I'd been to in Sydney was an all-girls high school. So I had that adjustment to make, which was adjusting from an all-girls school to a co-ed school is a bit distracting. I think probably people who've been through it would understand. But then I did the leaving in 58, and I then joined the public service. There wasn't really much else offering in Canberra for employment, so pretty much straight from school, I became a clerk in the Department of Immigration.
What sort of responsibilities did you have there?
I think it's a bit hard going back that far, but I think I started off in the registry, which I think probably is where they put people until they could get a fair assessment of you. And I can't remember the chronology of the jobs I had there, but the main time I think was spent in the passport office. Passports were all written out by hand, and we used to have to bundle them up into batches and send them off to embassies overseas with sealing wax and string. And this is in the late 50s, probably 1959. Writing out passports by hand, having to write tidily, keep records. I was very much the junior in the office though. And then I decided that I wanted to travel overseas, so I left the public service, probably a bit rashly, because I wanted to save money. So I became a governess out in the wilds of New South Wales, up near Tamworth, because I thought I'd be able to save money by doing that, in order to save more money in order to travel overseas. That didn't really work out like I'd hoped, so I came back to Canberra after about 4 months. And then I got a job as a stenographer, initially with the Department of the Army, because I wanted to learn shorthand typing in order to get a job in London, which was what I knew I'd have to do over the winter in the UK. So that's my employment history up until probably about 63. I did actually work for the South African Embassy for a year before I went overseas, which was interesting. Then I had 2 years based in London, travelling, working, and then came back to, and I was working in Australia House over the winter. And then I came back to Australia and I worked for solicitors for 12 months. And then I got a phone call one afternoon from John Menadue asking me if I'd be interested in a job being interviewed for a job in Mr. Whitlam's office when he'd just been 2 months before made Leader of the Opposition.
Stepping back just a little bit, where did you learn to stenography?
I went to night school. I went to the Metropolitan Business College, of course, the family company. I didn't have to pay. My father's cousin, John Sarissia, was running it in those days.
This was here in Canberra?
There was a branch of the college here in Canberra. The headquarters was in Sydney, but there was a branch here in Canberra. So I went at night to learn shorthand. And, of course, I learnt Summerhayes shorthand because that was the family shorthand, which my grandfather invented. He had been born in Young in New South Wales and had left school to become he went to work for the local newspaper, and he learnt Pitman's shorthand for that job. And at some stage later he became a court reporter. I don't know whether that happened in Young or when he moved to Sydney, and he just decided that Pitman's shorthand, as I remember being told, had too many exceptions to rules. You would learn a rule and then you would have to learn the exceptions to the rule, and he decided he could invent a form of shorthand which didn't have those problems. So he created this Summerhayes shorthand, which was only ever taught at the Metropolitan Business College in its various branches. I think there was a branch in Newcastle and Parramatta and Sydney and Canberra, but never outside of those places. So yes, I learnt at the college probably in the period while I was still working in immigration, I think, because I wouldn't have, I got a job as a stenographer when I came back from governessing, so I must have mastered it by then.
So you don't actually have Pitman's?
No, you could only, people like me, average people, could only learn one form of shorthand. You'd be far too confused if you learnt the two forms. But my grandfather, having been dissatisfied with Pitman's, I mean, he was obsessed by shorthand. In the end, towards the end of his life, he used to write his checks in shorthand. So, but no, most people wouldn't manage, wouldn't do. Look, I know quite a few people who learnt shorthand. Rob Chalmers, who was in the press gallery here for a long, long time, he writes Summerhayes shorthand. There's still a few people around.
So is it that's difficult to make a comparison with Pitman's in terms of...
Well, I can't. No, I can't. I mean, no, because I only learnt one form. So it was his judgment, though, that the problem with Pitman's was that there were too many exceptions to the rules.
You mentioned that John Maynard rang you up and said, are you interested in applying for the job, basically? How would he have found out about you?
Ah, well, you see, it's not what you know, it's who you know. He knew this man, John Sarissia, who had taken over, I suppose, my father's position in a way as running the business college. I don't know where he knew John from, but John was my father's cousin. And I think they got approval for a new position. They were setting up a new office, really. They had a few positions to fill. And John Menadue rang John Sarissia and said, did Sarissia know of anybody who might be interested in a job like this? And Sarissia thought of me and gave, presumably, that's where John Menadue got the... Well, I know that's where he got the name from. And so he then rang me and I came over here for an interview and...
Yeah, tell me about that. Who actually can you remember who interviewed?
Yes, John Menadue.
So he was
senior private secretary to the leader of the opposition. Oh yes, I remember that quite well. I remember one of the questions he asked me, which surprised me a little, was whether I was a member of any political party, which I wasn't, but I was interested in his explanation. He said, we obviously wouldn't really want to employ somebody who was a member of any other political party, but we don't also really want somebody who's a member of the ALP. He didn't explain at the time, but I think now it was probably because as a member of the ALP, you could be at a branch meeting and you could be putting your point of view and it could be misinterpreted as maybe Mr. Whitlam's point of view or somebody else's point of view. So I think that was the rationale for that.
What did it feel like coming in and being interviewed by a senior member staffer in an old Parliament House?
Oh, I was a bit overawed. I don't think I'd ever been in here before. I think that was the first time I remember being here. I had a friend who was working here. And I had also, she was working for the government at the time, and she probably gave me a bit of a feeling for what to expect in terms of the physical building and maybe how life was. And also I had friends who were journalists who I remember, they hadn't been in Canberra very long themselves, but very happy to offer advice on how things might be in Whitlam's office. So I had a bit of background briefing, I suppose, from people who had some connection with the place.
Can you remember where the interview was held?
I can. It was in the room M57A, I think it is. And John Menadue's office in those days, initially in 67, this was April 67, I guess, backed onto the internal reps courtyard, had windows a bit like the ones where we have now with that sort of iron fretwork or whatever you call it there. I don't remember any details of what sort of questions I was... I guess they were fairly routine about where I'd worked, what I'd done. As I said, the question about political involvement.
And did he offer you the job?
He did. I can't remember if it was then and there or a little afterwards. I don't even remember having to give referees. I suppose I did, but he probably rang around a few people who... Because I'd been in Canberra by that stage, 10 years or so.
What sort of salary?
Oh, I don't know. I can't remember.
Better than, was it an, would you, you regard it as an improvement or a promotion in relation to, compared to what you were doing?
Well, it certainly wouldn't have been any more money than I would have got as a clerk in the public service, which was, I guess, what I'd moved away from at that stage. I moved back to that. But in terms of what my weekly salary was, I can't be specific. But of course, we worked incredibly long hours, so we used to get paid overtime, which brought one's pay packet up a little.
What was your first impression of Old Parliament House when you first came, when you came in here for the first time?
I suppose it was just the large size of King's Hall and sort of finding your way across that, because you know where the opposition corridor is, it's sort of diagonally opposite. You come in the front door and it's sort of, you had to head almost right across King's Hall. As I got to know it later, that table which was there with the Magna Carta on it, and Alan Reid used to be always leaning on it with one elbow, catching people as they went by. Beyond that, no, I don't have any marked impressions. Just that size of King's Hall, and then, I mean, we just went straight in and into the manager's office.
Were you interested in politics before you came here?
Not particularly, no. I think probably if I had, how old was I? I was 26 or something. I had voted, and I suspect I hadn't voted Labour. I didn't think much of Arthur Calwell, to be honest. So I probably was more interested as a, I wasn't a flibbertigibbet, but I wasn't particularly interested in political parties' policies. I was more interested in how political leaders presented Australia overseas, and I didn't think that Calwell perhaps was the best between Menzies and Calwell. And I remember noticing when Whitlam became, I suppose, deputy leader, and I remember noticing something in the paper I particularly remember. So I was reading a bit about politics. I just remember particularly Margaret Whitlam's long hair, which she used to wear in plaits wrapped around her head. And I've still got a sort of an image, that image in my head of when Whitlam first came to my notice.
So would you say that while you were working here, you became interested in politics?
Oh, yes. Yes. You can't avoid it.
part of the system.
Part of the system. Well, yes, it was work. It was the lifeblood of the place.
Can you remember your first day on the job working in the,
I can.
The opposition leaders?
I can. It was a bit dramatic. It was the day before my birthday. My birthday's on Anzac Day. So it was 24 April 67. And I don't think it was a sitting week. Well, it was Anzac, the day before Anzac Day, so it wouldn't have been a sitting week. But for whatever reason, Mr. Whitlam was in town, and Mrs. Whitlam and several others of the staff, and there was some sort of a reason to have a press briefing in his office. So, because I was employed to be the stenographer to Graham Frydenberg, who was the press secretary, I had the task of going into this meeting and taking a record of what was said. And we had to take extra chairs in for the press to sit on. So just took the extra chairs in, had the press briefing, took the notes, went back to my desk. And the next thing, a chair came flying through the air, landed on the floor beside me, and I turned around a bit cheekily and said, "Who threw that?" And there in the doorway was this tall E.G. Whitlam with an absolute puce face. It was a bit of a baptism of fire for me. I sort of soon withdrew into my shell a little and stopped giving cheek. But it was just one of those. He obviously tripped over this chair, which I should have thought I suppose I didn't think, but if somebody had suggested maybe it's time to take those extra chairs out of there, it mightn't have happened, but it was interesting. So I remember that particularly. Beyond that, I think there were quite a few of people around, and there was probably a lot of activity that I didn't understand what was happening, but they were only there for that day, the day before Anzac Day. Then we had the holiday for Anzac Day, and the following day I think some people were surprised that I turned up for after that Tuesday first day's experience, they were a bit surprised that I came back for more. But and that day after Anzac Day, the 26th, the only people around were John Minajew and one other member of staff, so life was very quiet, and I think I probably typed a speech or something like that. We could get on with those sorts of tasks.
The within, first of all, were you working in the space next to 57A? Or?
We had rooms 57, M57 and M57A. I don't know quite which is which. One was the sort of waiting room where Irina, who was the receptionist, sat, and she was immediately outside Mr. Whitlam's office. And then we had the space between that door and the deputy leader of the opposition's office, which was closer to King's Hall. And I think that was M57. One door was into Graham Frydenberg's office, and I was up against Graham Frydenberg's office was say on my left here, and then we had a sort of a half wall, and I had a desk up against that half wall, and my colleague Barbara Stewart had a desk right next to me, again up against this half wall. So we only ever had desk space; we didn't have offices.
What sort of out of interest? What sort of equipment did you use? What kind of typewriter did you have?
I think we must have started off, or in 67, must have started off with manual typewriters. I know we graduated to those IBM electric golf ball machines. They were the first electric typewriters, and we had those, but I can't fix now the timing of. Then we went, we had Hermes electric, we ended up with portable electric typewriters, but I think they were golf balls. So yeah, I think we started off with a manual flick of the carriage return. And then moved on to the golf balls, and that's about as far as we got in those days. I think we didn't have word processors or typewriters with memory.
No. And what was the structure of the office like, and how did you, in a sense, where do you fit into this? There are a number of people mentioned in Jenny Hocking's biography of Gough Whitlam, and also in Graham Frydenberg's book, his memoirs, where they mention a number of names. If I read some of them out to you, could you perhaps tell us a bit about them as individuals? The first one is Irina Kuznick.
Irina Kuznick, yes. We used to call her the princess, the Polish princess. She died, sadly, a few years ago. She was the receptionist, and she was working already in Mr. Whitlam's office when I started. She used to greet people as they came in the door. She was probably the person who ushered visitors in and out of his. She was the gatekeeper, I suppose, in a way, because she sat between the corridor and Whitlam's office. And she was a stenographer. Like, it was fairly democratic. The men were working on high-powered policy, while we girls just were girls and we just typed. I mean, life's very different now, but in those days, girls were girls, and we used to occasionally say we're not paid to think, which I'm ashamed to think of, but that's a bit the way it was.
I intend to come probe that matter with you a bit further down the track, if I might.
Yeah.
Did you have any direct dealings with her?
Oh yes, we were all very good friends. So we had three girls in the office in those days. There was myself, there was Irina, and the third was Barbara Stewart, who had been working for Mr. Whitlam as deputy leader of the opposition. So she came over from deputy days. I think the princess came in once he was made leader. I don't really know where. The timing of when she came to the office, but I think she came at the time he was made leader in February 67. So we were the three girls, and we were all stenographers, and then we had the men, and the senior private secretary, as we talked about, was John Menadue, and he really was the senior staffer who had an enclosed office with a door that you could be closed. Nobody else did. We had, at that stage, John Menadue, he is a very nice, soft, gentle, fairly gentle man who I took to immediately. He was fairly quiet. By contrast, the other two men on the staff when I first joined were Graham Frudenberg and Peter Cullen, who used to frequent the non-members' bar rather more often than John Menadue did. And on quiet days, Graham and Peter, who used to look out for each other somewhat, would often just say, "We're down on, what was the phone number? 169 or something." He'd just leave a message saying, "We're on 169, which meant they were in the non-members' bar. But John was a son of a Methodist, straight-laced family. He's not as straight-laced now as he was then. But no, he was a very nice man. Now, he moved off from that job probably about 6 months after I started, because Race Matthews came into the job then. I think John went off. No, I don't. Anyway, it's not his life story. I don't remember exactly where John went to, whether he went to work for Rupert Murdoch at that stage, which could have been the case. But he also ran for election, stood for the seat of Hume. Now, when there weren't reps elections in 67, so that must have been the 69 election. So the timing of his move is a bit unclear in my mind now, but he was the senior private secretary. He seemed to be mainly involved with a group of policy committees, which the Parliamentary Labour Party had established in those days. So they had a sort of a committee which advised Whitlam, I suppose, rather than the caucus, on, say, science policy. And they had another committee which advised on, say, health issues. And there were groups of probably academics, interested experts who were sympathetic to the cause. So John seemed to be organising or be involved with those groups of anybody else, more than anybody else in the office. Peter Cullen used to look after some sort of, I suppose, internal party things. He had worked for Senator Pat Kennelly, who was, quote, the kingmaker in the Victorian ALP. So Peter knew the ALP pretty well. He used to do a lot of the correspondence, there was an awful lot of correspondence came into that office with people with suggestions, and Peter used to draft a lot of those responses. And then Graham Frudenberg, the third male member of staff, was press secretary, oblique speech writer. His strength really was in speech writing. He was a nocturnal creature who wasn't always around for the afternoon press's phone calls. They used to be gathering their stories in the morning, and Graham was never there in the morning. So other people filled in, answered questions. It wasn't a rigid delineation of roles, because that wasn't very practical.
Hmm. There is a reference to another female member of staff in these two books. Lorraine Hall.
Oh, Lorraine Hall. Lorraine Hall came onto staff after the Princess left. Irina left. I think she left and joined Foreign Affairs. She went to Rome to the work with the embassy in Rome, where she met an Australian fellow and married. So Lorraine Hall came into Irina's job, and she filled that receptionist position, receptionist stenographer. We all had to do a bit of everything.
Yeah. So exactly what was your role in this office?
Do anything you were asked to do, really. It was certainly, I was the principal stenographer for Graham, and most of my time was spent doing his work. He used to dictate very slowly. And as I said, he's nocturnal. We would be here sometimes till 10 o'clock at night, and I used to sometimes time it to see whether my Summer Hayes shorthand was up to speed. And instead of doing 120 words a minute, as most good shorthand writers can do, Graham was dictating at 3 words a minute. Very slow, very deliberate. When the words came, they were almost always the right words. He didn't change much afterwards, but he paced the floor, smoking, dictating, but at such a slow pace, it was painful. But anyway, that's the way he worked. And as I say, when the words came out, they were usually the right ones.
So you actually worked, you know, as far as being a stenographer, you really worked with him.
Yes, I did. But I also had to, I took dictation from the leader, as we call Mr. Whitlam. And I probably also used to have to take, if Peter Cullen had a whole batch of letters that had to be answered, one of us would go in and just take notes from him and do those letters. We all did a bit of everything.
Including perhaps taking notes that you did at press conferences?
Press conferences, yep.
What about those committees that you mentioned?
No, we weren't involved in any of those. They used to, and they probably weren't as formal as committees, but they were sort of, I don't know, I'd call them now advisory groups or think tanks, or little think tanks or something. They just would sort of look at devise a policy, look at the ins and outs. But it was something that I don't think happens much more these days.
When John Menadue left, he was replaced by Race Matthews.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit about him?
Race was Race came from Victoria. He had been, I think, a speech therapist, and he came into the job about maybe September, October 67. Again, a nice, quiet sort of a man, not a boisterous politician type. I was going to say that they didn't seem to be the sorts of people who would be interested in a political life, but both he and John Race became a Member of Parliament. They did have political aspirations, but you wouldn't have thought that of them on meeting them first, I don't think. They weren't sort of brash, outgoing types, it seems to me. They didn't seem like that in the office anyway. They may have had other personalities outside.